Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
I'm back. I'm chapsticked. I can rock it.
Molly's back. She's got her chapstick mirror all set. It was an emergency, we were told. Hey, everybody. It's Kyle Rizdahl. Welcome back to Make Me Smart. It is Tuesday. Deep dive, single story. Lots of good stuff to be learned from everybody. And that's what we're going to do.
Today, we have one of our favorites on. Our very own Mariel Segarra, yes. Marketplace's retail and consumer psychology reporter, because consumer psychology is like the question of the day right now. What are people thinking? What are people buying? What are they thinking about what they're going to buy? And in many, many cases, what money are they buying it with? Because we have yet to see the data on what the loss of the $600 a week federal unemployment check means for the economy. But I believe we know it had injected, what was it? I think the number was in the trillion. American pocketbooks, a lot of money. And then meanwhile, obviously online shopping is here to stay. And Walmart, like, finally actually launched a competitor to Amazon Prime, Walmart Plus, which would have seemed to be overdue, except that you could also argue now's the perfect moment. So lots to discuss. Yeah.
Which is why Mariel's here. And so first of all, thank you for coming on.
Hello.
I'm going to start with this, though. Let's go back to the beginning of this thing and do a little compare and contrast for me on how we were spending back then versus how we seem to be spending now and the moods that we were in.
Yeah. I mean, I think the most surprising thing to me about this whole thing is, despite the deep recession that we're in, a lot of people are still shopping, so much so that when we got the latest retail numbers, sales were actually up compared to the same time last year. It's just that people are buying different things than they were. So, you know, before the pandemic, people might have spent a lot of money on going out to restaurants and bars and buying clothes, also on travel experiences, that sort of stuff. All of that sales have dropped, but now people are buying equipment to, like, build stuff for their houses. They're buying lumber to make desks. Like, yep. I interviewed one guy who said, you know, on Saturday, I wake up, I have nothing to do. I walk around my house looking for stuff to fix. And then he goes to Home Depot. I think it's really interesting because I think a lot about the emotions and psychology around what we buy. Mm-hmm. And it shows me how we, as Americans in particular, have been trained to consume. Like, we are consumers, like it or not. It's a compulsion. It's a, maybe you think it's a patriotic duty. Maybe it's just a emotional release, like retail therapy. But people keep doing it if they have the money to do it.
I actually saw it described on Twitter recently as the closest thing most Americans have to religion.
Yeah.
But how much do you think that some of those changes will remain? Because what I have found is I must have spent a lot more money on travel than I realized.
Oh, yeah.
Because now I'm like, oh, all that money I spent on weekend getaways or family trips or flying my mom out for holidays or something like that is, like, now not being spent at all. But I wonder, what is the kind of, like, relative decline in high ticket spending, you know?
To your point, I mean, some people are still saving money despite, like, you know, spending more on home and garden or whatever, because it's just so expensive to travel or to, like, go out to restaurants. Like, I went the other day for the first time in New York and sat outside at a restaurant and had, like, an appetizer and two drinks. Mm-hmm. And we split the bill and it was $100 between the two of us before tip. And I was like, is this what I used to spend to go out, you know,
And you didn't blink probably back then, right?
Yeah.
That's exactly it. I found the same thing. I was like, oh my God, this restaurant is expensive. And I used to come here a lot.
Yeah. I guess also from the personal perspective, like, I've noticed too that I'm actually buying clothing. I've gotten sucked down the Pinterest rabbit hole. And I'm like, ooh, denim overall shorts. Like, I need those. Right. And I'm just buying stuff and like trying to look cute, you know, because what else can I do?
Yeah. And it makes me wonder if that sticker shock will stay, I guess, you know, as an ongoing habitual thing where all of a sudden I will be way more price sensitive to the Thai restaurant.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. So this goes to what we were talking about before we turned the microphones on. And we were talking about a story that you did on Marketplace yesterday, Marielle, about having gone back to the office to pick up some stuff. You went out to get some lunch and you walked around some of the places near the Bureau of New York and asked these restaurants and markets how they were doing. And then we got talking about your commute and how, you know, you're not sure if you want to go back to a commute of an hour every day to get to the office. Yeah. And so the question is, to the price sensitivity thing and all that jazz, are you interested in going back to a place where you spend $55 before tip on, you know, an appetizer and a couple of drinks? I don't think a lot of people are going to be wanting to do that.
I think I'm going to be much more selective. For instance, those lunch places we talked about, I ate there out of necessity. And a lot of them, you'd spend $20 on lunch. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Like now, I just toast up some sourdough bread. I put my tomatoes from my garden on that tomato sandwich.
Right.
It's unbelievable how much I was spending. And I don't think that I or a lot of people are going to want to go back to spending that just casually. Like people want to spend that for experiences that they're really... that are really worth it to them.
Right.
And now it's like it's become obvious how much they were spending before.
I think it really has. And I just wonder, we were talking yesterday on the show about the kind of like path dependencies that we're creating in this moment that we don't realize. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I mean, your story about downtown lunch places was just so fascinating. We don't know what the restaurant industry is going to look like. And it might be that we go back to right when it was really, truly a luxury. And I wonder what other categories might end up in that bucket. Like, it doesn't seem like, to your point, we're becoming less consumery.
Right. But there had been this huge shift towards experiences before all this. Like, especially millennials and Gen Z wanted to spend money not on gifts, you know, for the holidays. I would buy my mom tickets to do something together, for instance, for Christmas. And now we can't really do that. So what do you spend money on? You buy stuff again.
Oh, God, we're back to stuff.
Yeah, wow. I think we're back to stuff.
That's a really good closing of the loop right there. That's really interesting. We've sort of come full circle-ish. So look, now what happens, right? Because some of the markets and shops around the Marketplace Bureau in Midtown East Manhattan are probably not going to be there in 6 months. Smaller retailers, as we've talked about on Marketplace, are not going to survive. Do you think we're ready for that as consumers? Do we have a sense of how different things are going to be? I mean, we talk about it all the time on this podcast, but I'm not sure everybody's absorbed it.
I don't know. I think it'll bring up a lot of emotions for people. It'll be too late once they figure out that they want to still patronize that local restaurant. You know, I've definitely walked around my neighborhood and been like, that place is closed now? Like, you know? I do think that what you'll see in a lot of cities is a trend we'd already seen in New York, for instance, where it's just like more and more chains. And chain restaurants are the only ones that can afford to be in Union Square, for instance. So you see like a Bank of America, Chase Bank, all of these ATMs, plus like, name just Salad or wherever other restaurants. And the little ones disappear. And I think that you're going to see that even more at the end of this pandemic, whenever that is.
Super. What about, as long as we're on the downer train for a minute, and I don't mean to make light of it, what do you think we're going to see when we start to get the numbers now that people are not receiving federal assistance or expanded federal unemployment?
Yeah, I think the other interesting thing about seeing how much people are shopping is it is a testament that the stimulus or the relief plan worked to a certain extent, that the $1,200 and the $600 extra in unemployment, that people used that to buy stuff. And that went away at the end of July. The retail sales numbers we have only go through July. So when we get the next ones mid-month, we'll start to see. And that came at the same time as there were spikes again in the virus around the country. And so people probably got a little scared again and like didn't want to go out as much. So I'm guessing that sales are going to drop and that it will have an impact, but I guess we'll see in like 2 weeks.
Right. All right. Maybe you can come back and tell us what's happening then. Mariel Segarra covers retail and the cool part, consumer psychology. It's all changing. Mariel, thanks so much.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Mariel. Talk to you soon. Yeah, I am not sure that we as consumers in this society have grasped how different things are going to be, truly.
I know. It's like a lot has changed about our lives, but we're still in this idea that, you know, there's some version of it that's going to come back. And, you know, it's worth noting another thing that was on the morning report. Many of the furloughs are starting to turn into layoffs. Many of the bridge loans, like whether, the PPP money that was keeping businesses afloat, that's starting to run out. Like there is still so much change yet to come. We have not even come close to being done changing.
Yeah. And you know what just popped into my mind, actually, is that thing Kimberly said early on-ish in this thing, that we did not have a chance to grieve what we lost because it just shut down and it was gone.
Yep.
It was dead.
Right.
Move on. And this somehow, I'm not sure what the logical flow here is, but this somehow plays into that, I think.
It does because we don't even know yet. We don't even know what to grieve. And there's like a new fresh hell every day, a new restaurant that was like hanging on that is now closing for good, you know, or a new store that was hanging on that was now, or like the Gap headquarters in San Francisco. They're just getting rid of this building, which has been like an iconic part of downtown San Francisco. And my friends who worked at the Gap for years and years are, you know, it's sort of like it's landmines and it's just going to be popping up over and over. But I do think we'll be feeling the effects. Like I want to go and play this for ourselves in 5 years when we only go out to eat once a month, you know?
Oh, that, you know what? We should play this in a year.
Yeah, totally.
I mean, 5 years, who knows where you and I are going to be, but maybe in a year we'll still be here, Molly.
Maybe. No promises.
Well, you know, I don't know what I'm doing tomorrow, man, let alone a year from now. Uh-huh. But anywho,
tell us what you're doing. I am also finding, much like Mariel, that I, despite having worked from home for 3.5 years, am now all of a sudden wanting to buy cuter clothes. Like, when it was a luxury that only I had to wear yoga pants all the time, then I was cool with it. And now I'm like, I need some cute pants. I don't want to be forced into it. Consumer psychology at work. So tell us what you think. Sure. Have your shopping habits changed? You know, what are you buying now? How are you buying it? How is it different? If you've been getting unemployment, tell us how that factors into the decisions that you're making. You can send us emails. We love the voice memos, 30 to 40 seconds. Make me smart at marketplace.org. It's a little fun to play our deadline game. You'll love it. We'll be right back. Pretend you're on the radio.
That's right. Ready to go.
All right. Time for the news fix. What do you got? You have an intriguing link here, and I want to know more. I'm going to click it.
Well, we've talked so long on this program, especially recently, about how there's this disparity between the haves and the have-nots, and the pandemic's only making it worse, and things are going to be different later. And here we have now Elon Musk, who, look, visionary, unbelievable mind, all of those things, yes. Also, slightly, he's just, you know, he's a curious individual in a lot of ways. But his net worth has increased almost $90 billion this year, which, number one, is completely, completely off the charts. Gilded Age, oh my goodness, what are you thinking? It also is a stock market story and people plowing into Tesla stock, even though it makes some minuscule fraction of the number of cars that General Motors makes, for instance. Yes, betting on the future, and I understand that. But once again, I said this yesterday, right? If you need a better example of how this economy is rigged to the haves and the have-nots, look at the stock market, right? Stock market with record highs, Tesla going absolutely just over the moon on the upside, and Elon Musk benefiting. And look, great, yes, he's driving that company, and I get it, but there's something not quite right. That's all I'm saying. Third richest person in the world has come out of nowhere.
Yep. I mean, I think the thing you're looking for that's not right is the price-to-earnings ratio.
Okay. Yes, all right,
but
fine.
Also,
you want to get
yes.
technical, sure.
I mean, I do, but I also, it's like, I have been delighted. Congrats to you, Wesley Faulkner, for bringing our attention to the K-shaped recovery concept really early. Yep. I have been delighted to see that proliferate through the national conversation. Now I feel like we almost need something stronger than the K-shaped recovery.
Yeah.
Because it's like you literally have a stratosphere and then the Earth's core in terms of how far apart some of these experiences are, you know?
Yeah.
Can we make like a science word for that? Let us know.
I don't know. Somebody will have a thought. Somebody
What's between thought. The stratosphere and the Earth's core? Like, what would you call that kind of recovery? Because, that's nuts.
Yeah.
I think somebody, I am repeating this from an editorial meeting that I wasn't in, but somebody said that the comparison was made that like Jeff Bezos could give every American $250 and then still have $8 billion left over, and that $8 billion would be the amount that his wealth has increased since March.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's a lot. And to be clear, nobody's saying these guys didn't build things, but they benefited from all kinds of things along the way that were designed to make them richer. Like, that's a whole other answer to my son's question of like, but didn't they build Amazon and that's really cool? Like, well, yes, but then here are all the helping hands that reach down, including hiding a bunch of tax money overseas. The end.
Yep.
What
do you got?
On a totally different other note of concern.
Yes.
Uber. Remember when we talked about Uber and Lyft and their version of a capital strike, which was like, we will withdraw our services unless you. So these tactics are spreading. Facebook. Oh, so in Australia, the country's basically like competition court. Has been proposing a bill that would require Facebook and Google to pay media publishers when content appears on their site. So like if a New York Times story shows up on Facebook, then Facebook should pay the New York Times. And in response to that proposed law, Facebook basically said, okay, well then in that case, we would just block users and news organizations, many of whom increasingly rely on Facebook for traffic, we'll just stop them from sharing any local and international news stories on Facebook or Instagram. That's just the only way. Paying publishers would never work. We couldn't possibly do it, but we definitely have the technology to block every single link to a news story that ever comes up, which is problematic for lots of reasons, not least of which is this sort of capital strike idea and the idea of using this dominant market share. Google followed and sort of suggested it would do the same thing. So using this dominant market position to extract favorable policy, I think we can agree, is problematic. But the even worse outcome is that you would end up, like, we already have a bifurcated information ecosystem.
Oh, yeah.
Like, there's what exists on Facebook and other sites, and increasingly what exists on Facebook, and then what exists in the rest of the media and the rest of the news world. And if all of a sudden all other forms of news, what we consider to be legitimate news, publishers that would, you know, need to get paid for their services, disappeared from Facebook, like, imagine the nightmare of disinformation that could occur. If it's already a bad echo chamber, all of a sudden it becomes one that's just a literal parallel reality. And that is truly, truly terrifying and frankly, deeply irresponsible for Facebook or Google to even be suggesting.
Yeah, taking the toys and going home.
Taking their toys and leaving everybody to just like... talk about dystopia. Anyway. All of this is in the new Neal Stephenson book, by the way. It's right there. It just predicted it.
Is this the New York 2041 book? Is that what it is?
No, that one's Kim Stanley Robinson, which is amazing.
Oh,
no,
right.
The new one's called Fall. And then it has some subtitle that's like Dodge in Hell, I think. It starts with like this massive hoax that is perpetrated to try to show how the internet can't be trusted as a source of information. But then the path dependency of that is that a whole bunch of people just decide they prefer the hoax And so America basically splits into two totally different countries with two totally different sets of information. Yeah.
Sounds, I think I read that in the newspaper today.
Doesn't Yeah, anyway, totally. All right.
That's the news from me and Molly today. We're going to do mail in a minute, but like we said the other day, next week we're going to do a deep dive into QAnon and a couple of points about it. Number one, we want to know what specific questions you have about QAnon because, frankly, you should have many, or if you've had a personal experience with them that you would feel okay sharing. And if you do have a question or want to tell us about what your experience was, get in touch, email makemesmart@marketplace.org, shoot us a note and let us know and somebody get back to you. And now we're going to do the mailbag.
Yeah. Hi, Kai and Molly.
This is Brent in Detroit.
This is Rebecca from Baltimore.
It was great to hear comments on my question about GDPR.
I wanted to put in my vote.
I want to discuss a slightly different but maybe related thing.
All right. First, we have a letter from Isabel Prosser, who wrote in about last week's show, which was all about that disconnect between the economy we all live in and the stock market, the stratosphere versus Earth's core. She writes, here's an edited version of her email. She said, Tuesday's episode, amazing. I thought I would send a message because I feel myself living in very different worlds. I'm fortunate enough to have a family that emphasized the importance of investing and investing in the stock market. A few days after New Year's, I turned 30. I started a contract role at a dream company. I was so optimistic that it would eventually turn into something full-time. Then COVID reached the U.S. I found myself, like so many Americans, out of a job and very unsure about my future. So on the days, most days, where I'm moments away from tears and feeling so hopeless about my future, I look at my stock portfolio. As strange as it is, the stock market is the one thing in my life that doesn't make me feel like I'm a complete screw-up. Life, like the stock market, is a long-term game, and while things feel low right now, I trust that we will rebound from this in time.
Man, there was a lot in there.
There's a lot in there. Yeah. You know, it's interesting because a tab I had bookmarked from this morning, actually, was this piece from yesterday on Bloomberg about Bill Ackman, the billionaire founder of Pershing Square Capital. And this is really interesting because he is talking about wealth inequality, and he says it poses actually a black swan type risk to investors. And one of the things he said is that the U.S. could combat that disparity with mandatory investing accounts for every U.S. born child. And so if you... I'm just bringing it up because it's super interesting. Yep. Like I was like, okay. I mean, it's a little bit like the answer to Facebook is more Facebook, but it is interesting. He says if returns continued to average 8% per year, which hope springs eternal.
Historically, they do, right? It's like 7%.
Then historically, they do. That a $6,750 investment at birth would yield more than $1 million by retirement.
Yes. Yay. We can't agree on whether we should wear a mask.
The government could also mandate that companies set aside a portion of workers' wages for a tax-free investment fund, similar to Australia's pension system.
The government could also flap its wings and fly to the moon. I'm sorry. Bill Ackman has obviously done really well for himself and by and large for his investors. But I'm going to insist that everything that gets proposed on how to fix American capitalism be reality-based. That's it. That's my requirement. Must be grounded in some kind of reality.
I'm sorry. The link is Business Insider, first of all, as a correction. Second, I don't know. Do we even know what reality is? Like, are you assuming a reality in which there's a functioning government or no?
Yes. I would let us start there, shall we? A functioning bipartisan government that operates in the national interest, not along party and individual lines. Let's start there.
That seems like a bigger problem. That honestly, functioning government seems like a harder problem to solve than like a proposal that there's mandatory investing accounts, which to me seems like a great capitalism-based system that everybody could easily get behind. But yes.
Yeah.
But you can't just like, you can't assume we will never be able to have solutions ever again. That is defeatist and it's only going to bum you out. You need some yoga with
Adrian.
Shocking
coming from me. Anyway, let us.
That made you so mad.
I was supposed to be in this document. I'm a little irate.
Yeah.
Okay, moving on. So,
okay.
We got a voice memo the other day, like we asked for. So thank you for the voice memo. It's about a story that you brought up on Thursday, Molly, about the University of Arizona catching a coronavirus outbreak on campus before it happened because they were testing the poop in the wastewater, which I just love so much. Anyway, we've got a listener who works at the university, and she had this to say. Here you go.
This is Eileen Segmuller from Tucson, Arizona. I'm a staff member at the University of Arizona. We have done so much preparation for this fall semester that it's unbelievable to me. We have leveraged our health science resources to the fullest extent possible through a test, trace, and isolate approach. We test at the university and in the surrounding community and have collaborated on a tracing app. This is all while our budgets have been cut, we are in a hiring freeze, and we have a furlough program in place. My colleagues and I are exhausted, but we are determined to do the best we can for as long as we can. I hope that eventually the University of Arizona will be an example of where a combination of leadership, sacrifice, and commitment can prevail. Bear down, Wildcats. Bear down.
Yes. Amen, Eileen Segmuller from Tucson, Arizona. That's amazing. And it completely reminds me of a series that we did on Marketplace with Jim Fallows from The Atlantic about five, 6 years ago. And his basic thesis was this. So Jim's a private pilot and he owns his own plane. And he and his wife and me on occasion with an audio engineer flew around the country and went to small towns. And what Fallows discovered, and he turned it into a book, more power to him, and it's going to be an HBO thing, more power to him for that. But what he discovered was that even as there is deep and critical dysfunction at the national level in this government, things at the local level are working out pretty well because people understand the problem, they recognize it as critical to them in that moment, and then they work together to solve it. And it was bipartisan, it was rural-urban, it was all of those things that make you say, oh, yes, this can possibly work. So while I am still irate about the state of our national government, I think the example from the University of Arizona proves the point that it can work on a local level when people actually dig in and give a hoot, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
Sorry,
And if you have a new baby and a little bit of money, set up an investment account. You can, because even a big national proposal that seems impossible can be applied locally for sure.
Yes.
I also love this because it shows that universities of all places have the, like, brain power and capacity to be creative and prepare. It's not that anybody is saying, you know, there is no universe in which schools can open. What we're saying is show me the Disney plan, your plan, and then you can do it.
Wait, hang on. Wait, where did Disney come from?
Because remember on the episode when we talked about Disney World opening and then some politician had been like, if Disney World can open, then schools can open.
Sorry.
And I was like, with exactly the same plan and resources and money.
Sorry.
To show me your Disney plan. Yeah, exactly.
Yes. Yeah, sorry.
All right, time for the Make Me Smart question this week, which also comes, the answer to the Make Me Smart question, which of course is, what is something you thought you knew and you later found out you were wrong about, also comes from Tucson. Here you go.
Hi, Kai and Molly. Dawn from Tucson here. My husband and I have been listening through our vinyl collection a lot in the pandemic, and one thing I thought I knew, but later found out that I didn't, is that the lyrics to the Kisses song, Rock and Roll All Night, weren't and part of every day, but rather party every day. I've been singing this wrong forever, but honestly, doesn't my version make more sense? Love the show. Keep it rocking.
Oh, man. Oh, my gosh. So that takes me back to when I was like 15, 12. I don't even know.
I was headbanging. I don't know what you were doing on your video, but yeah.
Oh, my goodness.
That's like one of the first music videos I ever saw. That is amazing.
Oh, man.
I love, Dawn is obviously an eminently practical person because she's like, it makes perfect sense. You can, it part of every day. You can't rock and roll all day.
And part
you just won't get anything done, but part of every day, that works. So awesome.
I love how you spin it into practical. That's so sensible. Of course.
That's very sensible.
This song from this band in the 70s that wore like nine-inch, you know, dragon teeth heels and Gene Simmons with the tongue. And, oh, my gosh. All right. Anyway.
Def Leppard. Ooh, boy. Kiss and Def Leppard is the first concert that I ever went to. True story. MBS Mark, wow. North Dakota.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Yeah.
I went to see Yes at Madison Square Garden. I was like 15, got a just crazy contact high from all the weed that was being smoked. But anyway. Also, and my mother does not listen to this podcast, so that's okay.
I'm part of every day. Okay. All right, that is it for today's show. As you can see, the best thing ever is when you send us your questions, your answers to the Make Me Smart question. Please keep them coming. Don't forget to sign up for our newsletter at marketplace.org/newsletters. You will probably have the origin of like those Kiss lyrics coming in your inbox on Friday. Tomorrow is What Do You Want to Know Wednesday. So send your questions in, makemesmart@marketplace.org. Subject line questions. I have a question. I even wrote it down. Can't wait for tomorrow.
All right. Well, we'll do it tomorrow. Don't tell me what it is now.
Mm-hmm. Yep, no spoilers.
Yeah. Okay.
See you then.
What do you want to know Wednesday? It's always a good one. It's like a marker. It's like, okay, we have turned the corner on this week.
It is.
Today, Make Me Smart is produced and directed by Rose Conlon. Yes, that's a new voice. She's here for a little bit. We are so grateful.
Welcome, Rose.
Tony Wagner is, as ever, our digital producer. Ben Hethcote does video. Ethan Parrott does all the work, frankly. I'm just going to say
all
that.
The work.
The interns do all
so
the work.
So much
work. Erica Phillips writes our newsletters, also our smart speaker stuff, too.
Today's program was engineered by Drew Jostad and mixed by Garrett Lang. Our theme music was composed by Ben Tolliday and Daniel Ramirez. The senior producer is Bridget Bodner, still crushing it, still on that honeymoon period. And the executive director of On Demand is Satara Nyemez.
No pressure, Bridget.
We haven't started yelling at her yet.
No pressure at all. Oh, man.
That's awesome. I also noticed that I still have my mask hanging around my neck from my morning walk. So today's fashion.
There you go.
Today's fashion brought to you by my sewing machine.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.